Welcome to Miracle Nutrition with Hardy White. I'm Hardy White. Join me now, my friend, as we travel together like passengers on a commuter jet to nowhere, talking about nothing in particular for no time at all. Let's meet briefly at the baggage claim and acknowledge our mutual baggage, and let one another near the belt when our bag comes round, and wish each other a good journey, never to see each other again. Oh, my friends, I want to share with you a story, the story of a trip I thought I took. I had to go to New Jersey to WFMU to do my show live on the air for the marathon and also to perform a live show in front of friends, a live audience. I thought I went, but when I returned, I realized that I had imagined the entire trip. It was, in fact, a dream journey. And today, I would like to tell you that story so that I can point out the clues that gave it away that it was in fact a dream and not reality. A lot of times we'll go on trips and we think we've been there and then we'll share the experience with friends and oh, the embarrassment of false memories. So if I recount this journey to you, perhaps it will help you not make the same mistake. The first clue that I was in fact dreaming was when I was let off at the airport at Lexington, Kentucky. I don't remember how I got there. I just remember I was standing on the curb with my bags. Now, I always carry a very soft duffel bag, so I don't have to check it. I can put it in the overhead bins, and I carry my backpack, which I don't really have anything to fill, so I stuff it full of books I'm never going to read, things I'm never going to use, pens, 50 pens, 40 crossword puzzles, comic books, other books, my, what's the electronic one, the Kindle, all that's in there, cords, things written on pieces of paper that I'll never need, stamps, don't know why I brought stamps, thought I was going to mail something, maybe I could mail myself there, that would save some time, wouldn't it? Lack of oxygen, though, in those boxes. So I entered the airport, and these days, you don't even have to speak to somebody if you don't want, you just have a little code, and you press it in to a machine, and the machine gives you your boarding pass, and it tells you, okay, go to this gate. Now, at very small airports, it's hilarious, because there's usually only one or two gates. So I went up to the security there, and I prepared to partially disrobe. I took off my overcoat. I took off my other coat. I took off my lace-up boots, which I chose to wear for some reason. I took off my 10-foot-long Sikh turban. No, I didn't. That would have been a pain to get back on. You don't see that a lot. People go, I've got to rewrap my entire turban. And a lot of those is a long piece of cloth like that. So I didn't have that, really. But I did have those darn lace-up boots. But I took everything off, and I put them all into the individual cafeteria dish containers that they give you. They normally put your, after you scrape your buffet plate, but this you just put your possessions in and everything. Empty your pockets, take off everything, take your wallet, put it in there, give it to a stranger, and they stick it in a machine and look and x-ray it in case your wallet has cancer. So I disrobed, I walked through, I did the thing where you stand in the what they call the Jeffries tube. I put my hands over my head in a pose of complete surrender and said, go ahead, look in my pants. With your machine, I have nothing to declare but my endowment. So I walked out, and they said, all right, you're fine. You've done this before. And I said, I do it once a year. And they looked at me like, is that could be some kind of code or something. But they let me go anyway. And I walked up to my gate, and then I sat there for hours or something because I am chronically early. I am so afraid of travel and flying, but not the dying part. I'm afraid of being late. I don't know why that is. I'm afraid of being of missing something, like that feeling of missing a train, that feeling of missing a plane. Not necessarily anything more than that horrible disconcertion. Is that a word? I'm glad I brought this huge dictionary in my backpack. I sat there for a while, and finally I got on the small commuter plane that would bring me to Atlanta. Atlanta, I thought you were going to New Jersey. Oh, yes, but I was on Robin Hood's Barn Airline, and they like to take you. Say, we're going to take you somewhere else first. It's like when you get in a car in high school and say, you're going to take me home, right? Yeah, but first we're going to rob a bank. Ooh, and that's what it's like. They put you, so I got on the airplane, very tiny little airplane, these commuter airplanes. Because I don't know why they don't. Well, I guess it's a small airport, and they say, we're going to take you to a proper airport first, and then start the process all over again. So I got in the tiny airplane, and I sat in my tiny seat, and they board you in order of your class. So it's just like a caste system in India. So the Brahmin class, they'll say, gold medallion Brahmin first, then silver caste, then something premium. They'll do about five of these elite. They keep adding elite classes to make people feel better. Oh, yes, I'm in the elite copper bronze seating area. And then they announce zone one, which are the first of the non-elites, but they're allowed to sort of associate with the elites. And then the untouchables of zone two. And that's usually me, because I don't know how much you have to pay. And I don't really know how the seat, two seats in front of me, is really any better. I guess they hit the mountain first or something. I don't really understand why that's preferable, especially on a small plane. There's no special treatment or first class or anything. We all seem to be trapped in this small vessel, which is reminiscent of the Civil War submarine, the Hunley. That's how I felt. So should I sit sideways and turn a crank? But it was a little more pleasant than I thought, because the flight attendant was very charming. Every once in a while, you get a flight attendant who's got a bit of a spiel, and it's wonderful. And you say, oh, that really lightens up being trapped in this tube of disease and stifling humanness. And so Steve said, welcome, and then did a spiel about the oxygen mask. We'll put the designer yellow oxygen mask on your face, that kind of thing. Put it on a child's face first in the event of a crash, and then it can watch you perish. So I went through all that. It was very relaxing. I sat there. They bring a little cart down the aisle, and they say, would you want water or Fresca? I say, can I have, this is crazy, but could you mix them up? It's called a Tom Arnold. So, okay. No, they won't do that for you. And they only give you half a can. So we're saving the other half of the can. I guess what happens is zone one gets the top of the Fresca, and everybody else, you get the Fresca after it's sitting there and something's dropped in it. But that's all right for me. I like to be that. I don't want to be special. I don't mind. So as soon as they pour it, then they reverse time and they back up and they go, when you give your glass back, we're done, we're there, because it's only a brief flight. So we land and Steve says, be careful if you're tall, the door is very short, so mind your head. And if you don't choose to mind your head, mind your language. This got a huge laugh, I think out of proportion to the comedy in it, but I was so charmed. Say, oh, I know Steve, that's a real person. It is, I'm not making that part up, am I? Well, I might be, because I'm telling you, it was a dream. Now, none of this was evidence that it was a dream yet, right? So I still thought I was in reality. It's funny how that happens. But I got off at the Atlanta airport, and I immediately knew that it was not real anymore. I found my gate. I looked up, and it's a vast airport, so I knew I was going to have to do some micro-traveling within my trip. So, it's just like a miniature city, isn't it? And I had to take the Concourse A train, which is a famous standard, and I hummed it the entire way. So you get on, you wait for that train, you get on, they say, welcome to the shuttle train. You're at Concourse A. Exit for Concourse B. Oh, I'm there already. That was nothing at all. But I was grabbing on that ring anyway. I thought, hey, we don't know if we're going to get stalled here. Another thing it does doesn't happen is the cast of A Lion King does not sing Circle of Life. They don't have time. So I just recited a limerick very loudly. I said, I'm Harley White, actually. And nobody knew who I was. It's funny that it's only in North Jersey. And even then, people go, yeah, I don't, from what, how would I know you? So I got off and I found my gate. And of course, again, I had a lot of time. So I just sat there. Now, this part, I don't remember at all. Now, this, I think, was the first indication that it was, in fact, a dream. Because I have no memory actually boarding the plane to Newark. It was a much bigger plane, and I'm sure there were many more people on it. But I got on, I found my seat. I was seated last. They invented a special zone 4 just for me. They got to look at me. Even though I think I was in my nicest suit, but it's all relative. And my nicest suit is not say, "Oh, you look like a professor from the 30s." Yes, sir. That's when my suit was first made, I think. So I sat in my seat, and a lot of times you say, "Oh, you know, it's the pleasure of the flight is sometimes dependent on who your seatmate is." And this was amazing. Not very often do you get to sit with a celebrity, but I sat down, and next to me sits a little girl, and she has tight black curly hair with a bow in it, and I look at and black eyes. Little dot, and I said, "Oh my God, that's Nancy. That's Nancy from the Funny Pages." And Nancy from the Funny Pages sat, I had the window seat, she had the aisle seat. And I said, excuse me, I hate to, you know, I don't want to interrupt, but are you in fact Nancy from the Funny Pages? And she said, yes, she is. And she was traveling to see Aunt Fritzy actually lives in Hoboken. I did not know this. I don't know where I thought it all took place, but I guess I didn't have it pinned for Hoboken. So we sat there, the plane took off, and oh my goodness, at some point I had to say, "That enough with the visual puns, Nancy." So no sooner had we taken off that Nancy crawls up into one of those overhead bins. I said, "Nancy, what are you doing up there?" She said, "I'm in my train berth." She had seen it on the Three Stooges. Also, she's from the 30s. I don't know if you know this. And she said, "I'm in my train." I said, "That's not a train berth. It's overhead. Get out of there. You can't nap in there." And everything that you could get in, she was in. She was in the little front pocket. She goes, "Look, I'm a kangaroo, Joey." And I said, "No, you're not, Nancy." And the name's Hardy, by the way. But everything, she kept doing that and constantly putting stuff on her ears that didn't belong and everything like that. Oh, it was exhausting. It did take me a while before I realized, hey, this is not Nancy. This is a tulpa that I've created through my meditations. What's that? That's like a sort of a mental golem that you make, a little creature. And I had made Nancy. And here she was, running around like that, up to her antics. And it really is maddening. You know, when you see it in the Funny Pages, you go, oh, how could they get mad at that little Nancy? I'm telling you, she's a psychopath. She has absolutely no respect for other people's belongings or anything. If you had a rug made out of a bear and she got her ball stuck in the mouth, she'd pull the teeth out of the bear to get the ball out and everything. So a lot of her antics are very destructive. But I had an affection for her anyway, and I'd tease her. I'd say, if they were coming for you and they said, "Shoot when you see the whites of your eyes, you'd be safe." And she goes, "Ooh, I'm just drawn that way." I said, "I think that's from a movie that hasn't been made yet on your timeline." It's very difficult like that when people are from the imaginary past, trying to figure out what do they know, what do they not know. Also, I had a very difficult time not touching her head. I really wanted to, especially because my hands were itchy because they're all dry from the plane. The plane sucks out any kind of air that you need and replaces it with special airplane air. I don't know why that is. Also, did you know that people order beer at 10:30 in the morning? I just thought I'd throw that out there. God bless you. I don't travel well on alcohol. So we arrived at Newark, our destination, and I bid her a fond farewell. I said, "Enjoy Hoboken. And hello to Sluggo and say hello to Sluggo's older brother or cousin, Spike, who was in the Navy in World War II, and whose tattoos of the names of his battles you censored by painting black strips over them. Just saying, I remember that. She goes, you really know my work well. I go, yes, I do. I'm very familiar. I've seen many of your strips. She said, thank you. It was a pleasure to meet you. And then, I don't know, she took something from me. I'll figure out what it is later. Nancy, coming for you. I got off the plane at Newark. Now, the airline that I was flying on has not a big presence there, so it's a very small concourse. And immediately I was there at what they call ground control. That's Major Tom. Ground transport. I had arranged for what they call a car service, which is like a cab without any markings on it. It's very dubious. You say, well, who's going to, somebody will pick me up. Yes, yes, yes. Well, are you sure? Yes. You want my flight number? Okay. Like that. Okay, here's my flight number. So somebody will be there. Oh, yeah, yeah. So I got there and I called the number and I said, hello, this is Hardy White. I have arrived at the Newark Airport at the appointed time. I'm now prepared to take my car to Jersey City. Like that. I said, I don't know. Hello. And they gave me another phone number. So I called the other phone number and I said, hello, this is Hardy White. Like that. I'm like, I can't hear you because it was, you know, it was noisy and everything. And I think the fella had an accent, but basically said, I have no idea who you are, who gave you this number. I was like, well, the car service. Now, this went on for a long time. I finally arranged for this guy to come pick me up. At this point, I did not even know if it was really a car service or somebody I just reached, but I convinced him to come get me at the airport. 40 minutes later, I'm standing at the curb. He calls me, says, can you hear me honking? I said, no, I don't. And he was apparently at the wrong level. We worked that out, and he finally pulled up in a really very, very, very old Buick that looked like it had been, it was very colorful because some of the panels were different colors and everything. They'd been taken from other cars. I saw how resourceful. He came around to get my bag, could not get the trunk open. I guess there's somebody in it or something, and he's just put my bags in the back seat. Now, usually when I've taken a cab or had a car ride or something, there's just one driver, but in this, there was three drivers. There was the driver, and then there was two, I guess, family members keeping him company. So it was just like riding with somebody and their friends. They weren't other passengers going somewhere because they're all talking amongst themselves about stuff. And I was trying to figure out what language it was in. And then I thought, even if it was in English, I really have no interest. I said, where are you going? I said, again, you don't know, but I'm going to Jersey City. And I gave him the name of the street and he repeated it like he didn't know it. And I said, oh, no. And then I was convinced that we were accidentally going to go to New York City. And so the whole ride there, I was a bit nervous. And I said again the name of the street, and he knew, I know. So I just shut up. And I sat there, and the car ride didn't take long. Oh, my goodness. It felt like some of the car wasn't with us all the time. He would speed up, and it felt like maybe the back of the car eventually caught up as we sped down the road. Finally, we arrived at my destination, which was a small office in Jersey City because I had rented one of them, sublet businessman apartments. And so I got off and I got my stuff and I went in and it was kind of like, this is another, I should beep every time it's a dream clue. Beep. Clearly not a real rental office. It was more like a place that you'd go, to get, like, if somebody said, hey, I got a friend that can get you a radio. So I went down into this kind of big empty office where it looked like they'd set up a desk maybe 10 minutes before I got there. And there was two fellas speaking and yet another beautiful world tongue that I did not understand. I came in and I announced myself and they said, oh, yes, Mr. Hardy. I said, well, really, that's my first name, but this persisted, this idea that my surname was my first name. Please sit down, Mr. Hardy, and let me arrange for you to be taken to your apartment. Thank you, sir. I felt very special at this point until I stood there for another 15 minutes unattended. Then it felt strange again. I looked around and I thought, this is not a proper rental office. And why are there so many boxes stacked in the back room? It looked as if it were a basis for a business, but not really one that rented apartments to tourists or businessmen or radio performers. In fact, it might have said apartment rental for radio performers on the window outside. Meep. Again, a warning that you are in a dream, that it is not actually happening. The next clue that none of this actually occurred was when the van pulled up to take me to the apartment that I had rented. It was also staffed with three drivers. I don't know if people are underemployed or they just like to bring friends with them to work, but I do not remember drivers having that many needs like that. I guess it's almost like you need a driver and then you need somebody to interpret the GPS. And that it's like planes. There's now a need for co-pilots, even though you'd think the GPS would negate that need. So the fellas then took me to this apartment that they apparently worked for, yet could not find. Again, another clue that I was in fact participating in a dream and not reality. They brought me to the apartment. Now, this apartment was a very strange one because it was I believe it was floating. It was a floating apartment building. It was actually jutted out on pilings in the middle of the Hudson River. Now, I thought this was very strange. I thought this can't possibly be real. And they let me off, and I walked in, and they say, you may need to show your key to prove you're supposed to be here. I said, all right, I don't get that. No one knows I'm coming anywhere, do they? What? So I got off, the van instantly disappeared. I don't remember seeing it drive away. And when I entered the building, it was yet another clue that something was very wrong. I acknowledged the concierge, but the concierge didn't seem to see me, as if I was invisible. And as I rounded the corner to go to the elevators, I realized that I was not in an apartment building at all. I was actually on a cruise ship that I was on as a very young child in the 70s. Yes, it was the Angelina Laura, a cruise ship that ran in the 1970s that was originally a World War II hospital ship but had been converted to a recreational, vehicle. What is it? To take tourists to the Caribbean and to fill them full of half-rotten buffet food and give them entertainment by drunken itinerant performers. So it had that kind of paneling, and it really looked like a cruise ship. I felt like I was going to my cabin on a ship. And so I got to the elevator. I recognize this paneling. And I got to the third floor and I started walking down the hall. And then it jogged to the left. And then it went straight for a while. Then jogged to the right. And then it went straight for a while. And every straight corridor was impossibly long. It felt like it was a mile long. And it's still, I wasn't anywhere near my room. I feel like I walked for hours and hours and hours. Beep. Again, a clue that I was, in fact, in a dream. This was no apartment building. My mind had conflated the ship I was on as a child with that horror movie where they're all in the big hotel. You know the one I'm talking about. The Shiner. So I go down the aisle even longer, and I finally find my room. I key in, and I open the door, and I'm overwhelmed with the smell of cleaning fluids. And the maids are still there, say, we have cleaned your room, and now we are leaving. All right. And it was a nice room, and it looked like a cabin on a ship. The first thing I was drawn to was the large glass window at the rear by the balcony, and I looked out. And it was as if I were on the water. I could see nothing but the Hudson River in the distance, the George Washington Carver Bridge out there in the distance. On my right, the skyline of New York City. On the left, the skyline of Miami Beach, but a kind of a grittier, weirder Miami Beach that had, as if somebody had forgotten Miami Beach was there and didn't clean it for a while or look at it and went, oh no, we've forgotten it. I used to have a dream that I had a pet, like a pet bird, and I had forgotten about it, and I went back and found its little abandoned skeleton. That's what was on my left. People now tell me that was Jersey City. I don't know. In my dream, though, it was neglected Miami. I guess it was the big skyscrapers. There was nothing but looked like large condominiums. And yet, the New York City on my right seemed to consist of all buildings from the last century. Nothing new. The new part was all obscured from my vision. So all I could see was New York City in the distant past. I stared out of that window. I wonder if we're moving. Will this ship move? Or is it a stationary ship? Is it like a museum ship? I stayed in that room for a good while. I looked around. I say, hey, I see Tom left the non-dairy creamer. I think I'll give it a whirl. It was like that. It was like staying in someone's borrowed apartment with nothing in it. You ever do that? You see somebody's real apartment that looks like a rental? And say, how could you not have accumulated things? Why is there Pier 1 art on the walls? Where's your sloppy paintings by drunken friends that you took in exchange for drugs or something? Why is there no clutter? Why are there no stacks of books? Why are there no papier-mâché doll heads like at my house? It was different. It was one of those places designed to accommodate anybody, but mostly a single man on business. I could tell that. There were no feminine touches. Everything seemed to be black leather. Not that ladies don't like black leather and chrome. Oh, what? I'm being terribly, terribly sexist there. I didn't mean it. I meant the old school version of taste. You know, that things with flowers on it were feminine, and that dead animal heads and were masculine. Now that we know that's all a lie. People like different things. Men and women can like the same things or different things. And I find myself drawn to more floral prints and was kind of upset that things were so geometrical, leathery, and chromey. It's like one big Barcelona chair. Left me feeling cold. I've never sat nude in a Barcelona chair. But I think it would not be as inviting as a nice, fluffy chair. I just want to tell you, for anybody who might come over to my house, I don't sit nude on any of my furniture. Just except the toilet, which I do, but everybody knows that. They say, oh, that's right. That's why there's a hole in the middle, so make it more sanitary. I agree. I think if a toilet was just a regular seat with no hole, that'd be horrible. Could you imagine? So I sat in that apartment for a while and had a little kitchen. I was going to play house. Then I realized it had like an easy bake oven with just a light bulb in it. Oh, that's not going to. Did you ever think that? So there's just a light. I wonder if that's the heating element. It wasn't. It's just that my oven at home, I guess the light burned out a long time ago and I didn't realize that it actually takes a light bulb so you can see your food cooking. You learn something new every day when you travel or when you don't travel and dream travel. So I sat there and I just looked at the view for a while, wondering if it were ever change. And it did. Occasionally a giant robot or a submarine would come out of the Hudson River. But mostly it was just planes flying over, very low. Low-flying planes and helicopters, one after another. I had had a dream before I came. Weeks before this dream trip, I had taken another, more dream trip. And I knew that it was a bigger dream trip, because I was on one of their military helicopters with about 20 rabbis. And I'm sitting there, and the one rabbi comes and hands out these kind of paper bibs that you get put on you at the dentist. You know what I'm talking about? They might be slightly quilted even. And he put one over my lap. He said, yeah, you've got to have this. I said, all right, okay, I'll do when in Rabbi Helicopter, Rome. I sat there and they said, you're our guest. Could you please do a Nagoon? And what's that? That is a wordless tune that begins a worship service or something. And I was like, I don't. La 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 la. I don't know. I just did so what? I think I did the Doctor Who, La 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 la. That anyway, they finally stopped me. And I said, "Well, you're really supposed to make it up or something." I don't know. I'm new to these helicopter dreams. And so that was reminiscent. When I saw that over the river, I thought maybe I was having some sort of premonition. But what good is a premonition that doesn't give you any details? What good is a premonition that you can only interpret at way after the fact? If I had known that I could predict the future with that confusing dream, but only now looking back in hindsight, does it make any sense? I feel like my whole life is like that. I feel like it was all some sort of clue leading up to the present. And if I could only have read the clue better, I could have been some sort of prophet. Is a prophet a person that can see the future magically, or a person who knows how to read the clues of consequences? I'll have to look into that. I don't know. I do know this, that the only successful prophet in the Bible is a huge loser. All the other prophets, ultimately, something bad happens to them, and no one listens to them. I mean, sometimes what they say comes true, but is that really the goal of a prophet, to be right at other people's expense, even though they die? Yes, we're all going to perish. Don't listen to Jeremiah, he's a downer. All right. Is that a successful prophet if you're right? Or are you a successful prophet if you adequately warn people and you end up being proved wrong because they change things? This happened to Jonah in the Bible. So, "I don't want to go to New Jersey. I don't want to do my mission." So, "Okay, Jonah, we're going to throw you over the side." He didn't want to do his mission of going to the king of Nineveh and saying, "Y'all got to change your ways." Finally, he does. He goes. He says, "Y'all got to change your ways." And the king says, "All right, we will. We don't want to perish." And so they do, and nothing bad happens to them. Now, is he right or wrong? Is that a successful prophet or a failure as a prophet? Well, he feels stupid. "Well, nothing I said came true." And God gets a little angry and says, "Shut up. What a ingrate you are. What an ingrate you are. Would you rather be right, or would you rather save people? Do you want the credit? Is that it? Do you want praise and credit? Or do you want good to actually happen? Do you want power? Or do you want good to actually happen? Do you want people to be saved? Or do you want a medal? Can you do something without getting credit for it? Can you appear as if you failed and don't know what you're doing and actually secretly succeed? Hello, who's saying that? It's me, Nancy. Nancy was back. Just temporarily, though, and then I rubbed my eyes and she went away. Why is she here? She's giving me some kind of signal. I sat there for a while, and I realized that time was ticking away. The sun went down. The sun came back up. When the sun went down on that city, it shone like 1,000 diamonds. With the one caveat that diamonds, in fact, do not shine at night. If you were to turn the light out on a diamond, you'd see nothing. So it wasn't really shining like a diamond, was it? It was shining like hundreds of thousands of lights from windows in distant buildings. It was like that, more like a disco ball. And it was compelling because some of the lights were different colors. And I couldn't stop staring because I couldn't get the scale right. How far am I from that city? How far am I that the Empire State Building seems 4 inches tall if I do that kids in the hall crushing your head thing or close one eye? And my perspective is now two-dimensional. And my hand can touch the top of the skyline. Because I've cut out a dimension. And it feels like my hand is right there. When I go back and I get my other eye open and I see those three dimensions, I realize how distant I am from the thing that I admire. How distant I am from the thing that I'm thinking about. Oh, and when I add that fourth dimension, am I even in the same area? Am I in the same room anymore? When I add time to the equation, how do I know that there even is a city? Oh, all these questions running through my mind. So I thought, you know what I need to do? I need to go to the ShopRite. I know that it's over there on 2nd or something. I looked at my little map. I said, I'm going to go to the ShopRite. So I went to the ShopRite, and I got myself a bunch of groceries. And then I made a little, at the end of aisle 18 in the Jersey City ShopRite, in my dream that is, there's a liquor store. I don't think this would really happen. But I went in there, and I thought, I'm going to get a bottle of whiskey. And I'm going to get some food, you know, just things I need, like Pop-Tarts or what have you, spaghetti. I got all sorts of things like that. Sausage. I always go right for the sausage. I'm going to get, I need Italian sausage. I need eggs. I need a loaf of bread. I need a tomato, which I ended up throwing away. Oh, what a waste. And I went back to my little room and I sat there. I said, why didn't you call anybody? Here's the thing. I'm secretly very shy. Why was that? You afraid of people? No, I don't know. Maybe I am. I thought you love people. I do love people. Then why are you afraid of them? I don't know. Do you love dogs? Yes, I love dogs. Are you afraid of dogs? No, not generally. I'm not afraid of dogs. Well, that makes sense. Do you love birds? Yes. Are you afraid of birds? No. Do you love people? Yes. Are you afraid of people? Yes. I know that's irrational. There's nothing they can do to me. I think what I'm afraid of is myself. I'm afraid that if I be myself, people won't like me or something. This, I think, plagues a lot of people that want to entertain or want to teach or want to talk to others. They just want to show you what they want to show you. Because basically, they want to be praised or liked. They want to be an unsuccessful prophet. They want you to look at them and think that they're somehow have something you don't have, maybe. And I'm afraid that if people know me, then they'll think less of me and they'll realize how flawed and weak I am, or how silly I am, or maybe how angry I get sometimes, or how crummy I can be, that I'm not really a very good person or something. Oh, we're all afraid of being judged like that. And why? Because you don't want to be rejected. Nobody wants to be ostracized and cast out. Nobody wants to be out of the club. Nobody wants to see a group of people laughing over there. Can I join you? Hello? That's one of the worst feelings. If you ask a group of people to write down their fears, one of them might be death. But I bet you that on that list in the top three, one of them is some version of being ostracized. Now, not everybody knows what that word is, so they might not write down ostracized, because they think, well, ostrich-sized? Yes, that's very large, isn't it? Yes, like an emu-sized? Thanks for the punning. Oh, there's nothing that puts up distance between humans, communication, like the pun. It's just like a wall. Here, I'm going to go. It's like a wall between neighbors. It's sort of useful, you know, keeps you on your side. Well, and Nancy with her visual puns, that's just aggressive. Oh, why are you messing with my stuff at the expense of a joke? I digress. And I digress for a reason. Because I like to. See, a lot of people say that Hardy, he rambles, his stream of consciousness or something. And I say this, maybe it sounds like rambling, and maybe it sounds like I'm going all over the place, but if we were walking from my house to the Kroger, I might take you on a route so circuitous, you would think that we're not really ultimately going to the Kroger. And yet, we always end up there, and we always end up in the preserved meat aisle. I wish I could break this habit. I'm going to try to be healthier from now on. Get back to the trip story. You're doing it again. I know, but if we were in a museum, we wouldn't just be walking through the halls as fast as we could. We would turn and we would look at a painting, and we would say, that there is a painting of a farmhouse by Moshe Gannon-Manatilis. What? You'll just get, don't worry. See that farmhouse in the distance? Look how he's made the light. I think Moshe Gannon-Manatilis is a woman. All right, whatever. Look how the artist has made the light seemed golden in contrast to the... And we'd look at that farmhouse and we'd say, I wonder who's in that farmhouse where there's little people in there. And we would go off and our imagination would suddenly go to another dimension. Oh, we'd forget where we were and we'd get in that farmhouse. But eventually, we'd pop back and we would be in the hall of the museum again and move on to another painting. That's what I like to do when I visit with friends. Let's take the time to look to our right and left and go off infinitely in either direction as we see things that speak to our heart. Well, I sat in that room and I thought, I guess I should go over to the radio station. So I walked over and I found the WFMU building. And it's an interesting little building. It looks like it doesn't belong. It looks like somebody just sat it down there. That's how I knew I was dreaming again. It definitely looked like a set, like a prop, like it had just been plopped there just recently and it didn't really belong there. That in fact, there's an empty lot there usually. There's usually just some gravel and some asphalt and a couple parking spaces. There's no building. There's no multiple-story building with huge music archives and lots of people in it and everything. So I went in and I pushed the button and I said, I'm Hardy White. And I always think people are going to say, who or what are you doing here or prove it or put it out there? But they let me in. This is how I knew, again, how I knew it was a dream. So I went up and I opened my eyes because I had them closed the whole time. So how'd you get there? I don't know. Just fear. I didn't want to see anything. I guess I smelled vinyl. And I walked into that building, and that building was populated by exceptional people. Again, this is a clue that it was a dream. There were friendly people, people that seemed to share the same love of discovery, open-minded people. People who had passions about certain things, about ways of communicating. And they were just ordinary. Nobody seemed intimidating or scary to me. They're just folks. Oh, I knew this was a dream. And I stood out like a sore thumb because I was dressed in such a way that said, I'm full of pretense. I'm putting on an act. I'm in my clown suit. I'm uncomfortable with being myself. And everybody else seemed sort of comfortable with the idea, but it was all new to me still. Oh my goodness, there I see the microphones in the distance. There I see the phone room. So it was the marathon, they were raising money. So a lot of volunteers come up. All these people that are listeners, the listeners come in to the building. You understand, there's no distance between the people that are sharing the things on the air and the people that are hearing it. They're equals. They're all together. And I thought, this is very dreamlike. And I hope I wake up in that little apartment, if that's the reality. Or I hope I wake up on the plane, if that's the reality. Or I hope I wake up in my bed at home. But this is a little too much. Will I really be speaking to people live in real time? This microphone looks a little bit like my microphone at home, but we're not at home, are we, Hardy?
No.
Oh, you're here with me?
I was there the whole time.
I didn't realize because you didn't talk to me the whole trip.
Well, I was waiting for you to say something to me.
Oh, I'm sorry, man. I didn't even know you were there.
Well, that's what you ought to ask or look. Sometimes if you don't look around, you don't see things.
If I'd known you there, I would have been less lonely.
Well, there you go. You're lost, silly.
So I think I might have done a show, but I'm pretty sure that I did not. I have no memory of what I said. I have no memory of it at all. I just remember getting done, saying thank you, leaving the building, and when I turned around, the building was gone, and I was back on Montgomery Street in Jersey City, New Jersey, all by myself. So I walked back to the apartment boat ship. This time I went past a large building with people on treadmills looking out right up against the window. And I could see my reflection in my overcoat and my bowler hat and my long white beard looking like Satie, like Eric Satie, the composer. I thought, man, I'm not Eric Satie. But I looked up at these people, and they were all running at me, full speed, running right at me, but not getting any closer. And there was my face superimposed on their feet so that it looked, if I closed one eye, like they were kicking me in the face and running. I walked a little farther and walked through one of them scaffolding things they put up, one of those tunnels they put by buildings that have construction. And I walked down that tunnel, and I was instantly became lost. I looked to my left and right and realized I was suddenly in some sort of museum. I thought I better just go along with the flow and calm down. And I looked to my left and saw a beautiful sculpture. And the sculpture was made of plywood and rusted iron. Iron. Is that right? Iron. I'm not saying that right. And I thought, look at all those beautiful colors in there. Look at that composition. That's extraordinary. It looks like some sort of primitive construction, but it forms a sort of simple picture. And I stayed in that museum for a while, just minding my business. There was one painting that looked like sort of like clear plastic up against a board. And under the board, there was some indistinguishable writing that you couldn't see, as if the artist was saying, we are all looking through some sort of opaque, obscuring film so that we can't see clearly the message that's being given to us. But we know that there's a message there. We recognize that it's writing, that there's writing on the wall, but we can't quite see what it is. And it never, ever occurs to us to just take and pull that plastic away and see what it is, because secretly we like to be fooled. I walked out of that maze, finally found my way back onto the street that led to the ship building. And I quickly hurried down the hallway. And it recalled a dream that I have. Sometimes when the most recurring dream that I have is being in a hotel or on a ship and sort of not being able to find my room. I've had so many rooms. I've been in so many hotels. I've been on a lot of boats, and I can't remember all my room numbers. I can't remember if I have my key or not. At the time, it seems like home. At the time, I could find my way blindfolded down that hall. There's a window of 2 or 3 days on a vacation where your room becomes so familiar you feel like you live there. Kids, that happens all the time to them because their life is much shorter. They've only been alive, you know, less than a dozen years or something. To them, those few days, boy, that's just like they live there and they get instantly acclimated. They fit right in. They know where their house is. They know the number. And I think that stuff that happens to you in childhood just sticks with you, this idea that I have all these homes that I leave behind and I don't know where they are anymore. They've disappeared. They might be still there, but they're not part of my life anymore, and I'll never find them again. And every room that I go into subsequently is just a little bit different. It's just a little bit strange, and I have to start all over again, feeling as if I'm at home. I walked into my apartment. It was night. I looked out of the window at the lights of the city. And then I looked sort of to the left to the lights of Miami, Jersey Beach City. And I looked in the water. And there was no moon. You know, there was no light. It was a dark, dark night. The only lights were coming from the buildings. But I could see something in the water. I could see something that maybe was the dark spine of a sea creature. But I realized what it was. It was old pilings. It was dolphins. You mean a dolphin like the porpoises? No, I mean a dolphin like a piling, like a mooring. That's what they're called. These pilings that aren't attached to a dock are moorings. And they have that very poetic name of dolphin. But what they were is, it was where a pier used to be, and all that was left are these stumps, and they've been broken down by water and wind and time, so they just look like sort of black skeleton bones. They are sticking up out of the water. Something used to be there, and it's not there anymore. But I can see just the last vestiges of it, as it's totally erased from time. Just like memories, fading away. Your memories are like docks on a water. They're like some wooden structure built close to sand or built close to the sea, so that time takes its toll on it very quickly. And something that had such firm construction, something that was so useful, something that looked so timeless, is eventually and very quickly going to be worn away, much more quickly than the giant cement glass steel structures in the distance. Oh, the frail dock of my mind was being washed away by time. And eventually those buildings would too, but they'll last much longer than those little individual memories, our collective memories, our collective abilities and everything. They go on much longer, don't they? I mean, they're eventually, they perish as well and are wiped away. But the things we do together, they do last a little bit longer. I wanted to be part of something bigger.
You can be part of something bigger if you go to that darn station. You need to go now. Another day has passed, and you must perform your live show.
How could I do that? What do I have to say to people?
How do I stand up into a room full of people who came out to see me, that wanted to hear something, or convinced that I had something to say, or that I'd entertain them, or I'd inform them, or something? What if I let them down?
Oh, I couldn't do it. I couldn't go out there and tell them just an ordinary story. I would be afraid, too afraid. And why is that? Just to be myself? I'll tell you why. Because I didn't want to end up like Jonah. What if I say something? And what if the message is more important than me? And what if they think, hey, I don't really need old Hardy White. I just need this fact. I just need this information. It's made my life better. Hardy can go about his way now. He's done it. He doesn't have to be correct to have an effect. Oh, and then I realized how foolish that is. How foolish that is. I'm at age now, I should be grown up enough to not worry about being rejected by people. I should be confident enough to accept love. It's so hard. People are willing to give you love, and yet so many of us don't even want to accept it because it just doesn't seem like the right fit or whatever. Any kind of pants that I can get into fit. If they're too big, that's fine. Too small is the only restriction I have. If you give me pants that are too small, I'll appreciate it, and I'll look for a doll baby to put them on, but I'm looking for big roomy pants. But I'm never going to look for an exact fit. Who cares about that? As long as they cover up my butt, it's good enough. What's that an analogy for? I don't know. I think art, but I'm not sure. Oh, I'd like to tell you that show happened, but I don't remember. It's all a dream. I think I looked out on lots of friends. I think there were eyes on me. I think those eyes were saying, I'm also a human being. And I'll give you credit and affection for standing up in front of other human beings and making us feel okay. I just wanted to let everybody know that I have the same feelings that they do. That's all that's important, I think, when it really comes right down to it. I'm not a super learned person. I can't give a TED talk about something that really goes on in your brain or science or anything like that. I have nothing to say to anybody except, oh, I have all these fears, just like you do. That's the only thing I have to offer. And that doesn't make you look very cool, does it? That doesn't give me what I'd really want, which is some sort of perfectly fitting love. Tailor-made, bespoke love. It's not what's offered. What's offered is one size fits all. And boy, it can fit everybody. If you were there, and this is not a dream, that's amazing.
but I'm pretty sure it was. Because then I find myself back in that room, sitting and watching the skyline. And this time it was a different color. They changed the colors on the Empire State Building, just like they do the colors on the cross outside of some churches. You know, they'll drape it that way. Well, it's Pentecost, so it's red. It's Easter, so put a purple thing on the cross, or a white thing, or whatever. It's Christmas, put a plaid Black Watch tartan thing. I don't know exactly. I'm not an expert. But they changed the color on it, and I said, well, this, I know this is a different day, because now the Empire State Building is blue. And I think that this trip is coming to an end. And I think that this story is coming to an end. And I'll probably just do it all in reverse. Go back to the Newark airport, sit there for a few hours, get on a plane, say, yes, I'll have fresca and pretzels, please. And take my little pack of pretzels and open it up. And then I spread my pretzels out evenly. And then I fold my pretzel envelope back up. I'm very, say, you sound a little OCD, Hardy. I'm telling you, it's awful. And then I'll arrange my little tray, and then I'll eat a pretzel, and I have a thought, and then I'll take a sip. Oh, it's all very, I know. You say, well, that is really profoundly mentally ill. Oh, it's quirky mentally ill. It's different. And then we'll do the whole thing in reverse, and then all of a sudden, I will find myself, hours later, after reading a comic book in the Detroit airport that was given to me by my friend Todd. Oh, it was a Dick Tracy from 1950 and that Gravel Gertie. She had been in prison, wrongly accused, but she decided she wanted to stay in prison. For what reason? Well, ostensibly to play her mandolin for people, but really to uncover a secret drug ring that was being headed by the matron of prisoners and the woman's prisoners who was smuggling in cocaine in Gravel Gertie's mandolin, which he would then dump in the hands of the inmates. Where was she getting this cocaine? She was getting it from Measles, her son. So in an attempt to kill Gravel Gertie, the matron was killed. Measles, the drug-dealing, dope-dealing son of the matron, found out, all then tried to kill Gravel Gertie, who had subsequently escaped from prison, but ended up dragging Dick Tracy from the back of his car. Oh, battered and bruised, Dick Tracy, caught on fire because he fired his one last bullet into the gas tank of Measles' escape car. Caught himself on fire, but then finally his coat, his famous yellow coat, tears loose and he rolls down a snowy hillside and he lives another day. And of course, it's all to be continued, so I don't know how it ends. I don't know how any of these stories end. There's always some Dick Tracy story. Always come into it in media res. And always without a conclusion. How do I get anything out of a story that doesn't have an end? Well, I say this. I say give up on endings. Give up on beginnings. Be content with the middle of things. Just relax. Look to your left. That painting is another person. Look to your right. That work of art is another person. And they're just like you, deep and important and unique. And so don't give up on yourself. Don't give up on your story. Don't be afraid. Leave that little room. Journey out. Because even though WFMU might be mythical, it's a beautiful myth. And it's a beautiful dream to live in. So just be content with the limitations of things and know that there's an infinite amount of love and an infinite amount of intrigue in this crazy limited world we live in. You're listening to Miracle Nutrition on WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, WFMU.org online, or 91.9 in blessed Rockland County, where the folks all come together and listen to Hardy White, and their hearts change and their life changes. And just because you've been one way all your life doesn't mean there isn't more. Thank you very much for joining me and blessing me with this week and this show. To all my friends at WFMU, I already miss you. To all my listeners and friends, I'll see you again next week.
Sitter's Crossroads Gospel Broadcast here on listener-supported Freeform WFMU. Stay tuned for uplifting gospel music.
I got it! Oh!